Welcome to the Ideas Lab Predictor podcast from the University of Birmingham. In each edition, we hear from an expert in a different field who gives us insider information on key trends, upcoming events, and what they think the near future holds.
Today, we're with Dr. Jackie Blissett, who is a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of Birmingham. And Jackie's special interest is in food and eating, so I'm very much looking forward to this. What particularly do you look at, Jackie?
Most of my research focuses on feeding and eating in infancy and childhood. And what I'm particularly interested in is the role of the parent and the family in the development of feeding and eating through infancy and childhood. So, for example, what's the role of the parents in controlling their children's feeding and eating? What implications does it have, for example, if a parent has mental health problems, how might that be related to their control of feeding and eating through the child's early years?
We can't help but be affected by our parents' attitude to food, because as we're growing up, the family is our whole world, and all of our attitudes to food are conditioned from the very first moments, aren't they, by our parents?
Yes, indeed. And lots of research has shown that parents are really the primary forces in developing children's food preferences in terms of providing appropriate food for those children to eat, but also the environment in which they eat it. And parents' own attitudes towards eating and feeding are absolutely vitally important predictors of how their children then approach eating as they grow up.
One of the things you've been looking at recently is emotional eating, which is something that lots of people would recognise that they do, that they comfort themselves with food, and how this develops very young.
Absolutely. So almost all of us will be familiar with the idea of comfort food and of using food to change your emotion. And we know that emotional eating in childhood is quite closely related to obesity. So obese children have far higher rates of emotional eating. And actually, the more emotional eating a child does, the heavier they tend to be. What we've been interested in recently is looking at how these behaviours might develop really early in childhood. So we've been looking at the development of these behaviours in 3 to 5 year olds. And we've shown recently that it's not necessarily what your parents feed you, but the way that they feed you that might actually predict your tendency towards emotional eating, even as early as between 3 and 5 years old.
So how exactly do you research something like that?
What we've done in this particular experiment is we've taken a group of children and divided them into an experimental group and a control group. Children in the experimental group come into the laboratory, they eat a lunch with their parent until they're full up, and then they go through a brief emotion induction procedure, which is essentially doing a jigsaw and finding that a piece is missing and not being able to get a prize that they want. What we then do is we bring in some snack foods, a variety of healthy and less healthy, palatable and less palatable snack foods, and we pretend to look for this missing jigsaw piece for 4 minutes. And we see whether those children in the experimental group consume more food than those in the control group, depending on whether or not their parents use food to regulate emotion with their children outside of the context of the laboratory. The children in the control group do exactly the same, but they just have a jigsaw that is complete. So they don't have this negative period of negative emotion. And what we find is that those children who have gone through this mild negative emotion induction and have parents who use food to regulate their emotion will eat substantially more calories from specifically the sweet and fatty snack foods that we offer, particularly chocolate buttons and chocolate chip cookies.
So lessons for parents from that?
Well, obviously, the primary lesson is that we shouldn't be using food to regulate our children's emotions. So don't use food when your children are bored, for example. Don't use food to comfort your children if they're distressed or if there are other emotional needs that would be better filled with something else. Obviously, it's quite difficult often to come up with alternatives, but it seems to be really important to not engage in the use of food for emotion regulation behaviour, because it seems to really teach children to use sweet, high-fat foods to deal with negative emotion, which is something that we know to predispose them to obesity later in life.
So treat yourself in some other way.
Exactly.
That's not food related.
Exactly.
Okay. And what about for the grown-ups, if you're aware that, after a bad meeting at work, you hit the biscuit tin or whatever, is there anything you can do once you're grown up?
Well, I suppose that's part of the issue, isn't it? The being aware. developing an awareness of how you use food in terms of regulating your own emotional state. And it's a very personal thing, but it's advisable, certainly if you are overweight or an unhealthy weight, that you start to think about other ways of regulating your emotion without reliance on the use of food, high fat sugary foods in particular. There is some evidence to suggest actually that although people perceive, for example, chocolate to be very good at facilitating a positive mood, that the vast majority of those effects are actually all in our minds. They're all about just feeling that we've done something nice for ourselves or something indulgent. So you need to find something else that makes you feel like that, that you can substitute for your eating behaviour.
Emotional eating is obviously something that could contribute to a likelihood to become obese in the future. But there's a bit of good news on the obesity front, is that right?
Yes, there does seem to be some hopeful statistics. The recent health survey for England suggested that the obesity prevalence both in adults and children may be slowing or flattening out to some degree. It's important to emphasise, of course, that that doesn't mean the obesity prevalence is decreasing, simply that it's perhaps slowing down. We shouldn't be complacent, however, because we're still in a situation where 16% of our children are reaching the criteria for obesity and about 30% of them are overweight, which has obvious implications for their health and development in the future.
Being in a recession is obviously bad news, but it may be particularly bad for this area of our health.
Yes, that certainly seems to be the case. The Office for National Statistics survey shows that social deprivation is very clearly linked to obesity. And with the situation that we're in now in terms of the economy, the likelihood is that we'll see increasing disparities between those in the lower socioeconomic groups compared to the higher economic groups. It's very important that parents have the skills that are required, for example, to feed their children appropriate foods. Lots of the intervention studies show that you don't get effects on childhood obesity unless you have parents involved in treating childhood obesity. And those parents need to be very well supported. They need to have the skills required to, for example, prepare healthy food cheaply. And without significant resource and investment in the prevention of obesity, I can see that social deprivation is going to become even more important than it already is in terms of predicting poor outcomes for our children in terms of their obesity and ultimately their health.
And the question is hanging there, which is, as budgets get squeezed, it seems easier to cut prevention than it does treatment.
Indeed, and we may well see evidence of this coming through as a result of the NHS white paper that's been recently released. We've yet to see what specifically is going to happen in terms of public health and preventative budgets, but it would be a real shame to see a loss in the kinds of intervention or prevention studies that we've seen have some success across small groups of communities.
One last question from me. I know you're a mum. You also work in the area of obesity. Do you eat chocolate biscuits and chips or crisps at home? Or what happens in the Blissett household?
Of course we do. Of course we do. Life is too short not to. But the strategy we have with our children is that the foods, when they come into the house, are freely available. So if we have some chocolate biscuits within the house, the chocolate biscuits are available. If we don't want our children to eat chocolate biscuits, we don't buy the chocolate biscuits. And that's quite a good strategy, actually, for not making the chocolate biscuits seem extraordinarily valuable, and children don't necessarily pester you so much for them if they're not there. So yes, of course, there's always room in moderation for chocolate biscuits and chips. But the fruit bowl is also always full.
Dr. Jackie Blissett, thank you very much.
This podcast and others in the series are available on the Ideas Lab website, www.ideaslabuk.com. On the website, you can find out how to email us with comments, questions, or suggestions for future topics for the podcast. There's also information on the free support Ideas Lab has to offer to TV and radio producers, new media producers, and journalists. The interviewer for the Ideas Lab Predictor podcast was Lucy Vernal, and the producer was Andy Tootell.